Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Tim Cortese. In this episode of Oncology on the Go, we spoke with Kim Stravers, an Inelda certified death doula, about what the role of a death doula, death midwife, or end-of-life doula is. The conversation detailed who initiates the connection with a death doula, how their role is distinct from that of a nurse, and how she provides support to patients with cancer.
So you're an Inelda certified death doula. Do you mind maybe giving a bit of a background on kind of what a death doula does and what that role is like?
Sure. There are many different definitions that you'll find about what constitutes an end-of-life doula, a death midwife. There are also many names for this kind of work. The one that I like to, to center on, and the thing that I think is really the essence of any definition that folks will give you, is that we are non-medical companions to folks who are dying and the people who support them. So we provide emotional, practical, logistical, and relational support to people as they are confronting their mortality. We also support people who have survived someone who has died unexpectedly, whether that be through suicide, through accident, or simply a death that becomes more accelerated than we had anticipated in their disease trajectory.
For a patient who might still be living, at what point in that journey do you typically get involved, and who usually initiates that connection? Is it the patient themselves, or is it a member of the care team, or is it someone in the family?
It really can be anyone, and it can be at any time. So specifically for folks who are navigating a serious illness, sometimes they will call in an end-of-life doula at the time of diagnosis. And we know that the time of diagnosis can be anywhere, any stage, any time during the disease trajectory. So it's really up to them as to when they think it's appropriate to call in additional resources. Doulas operate under the assumption that there is already a support network available to the person who is dying. Maybe it is family members, maybe it is community members, it is their medical care team, it could be a faith congregation. So we don't come in assuming that we are in any sort of a savior role, or that we are going to come in and direct and fix what is unfixable. Dying is not a problem to be solved. Dying is a natural part of the human experience. So it really will be an individual decision. I will say that in my experience, I think both because we have a sort of global resistance to the idea of our own mortality, certainly in the United States, it's not a topic that you bring up around the dinner table very often. We have resistance to holding our mortality. And then also because end-of-life doulas are still not really part of the mainstream conversation about what it means to be receiving palliative care, hospice care, or just navigating serious illness, even if you choose neither of those options. I think that that is what drives people to wait until we get much closer to the end. So I would find that in my personal experience, I tend to magnetize people who are within that probably 6-month hospice eligibility window more often than not. It is my hope that people would engage a doula far in advance of reaching that stage, however, because we know that at the time of diagnosis, you probably are going to have the most access to energy, resources, critical thinking ability, cognition, and just the interest in even having these conversations. So as we get closer to a death, people's priorities change. And if you know that you have maybe 3 really good hours in a day, do you want to spend them doing your advanced medical directive? Do you want to spend them estate planning? Do you want to spend them planning for the last hours of your life? Or do you want to have a meaningful conversation with a loved one? Do you want to watch the sunset? Do you want to do something that brings you pleasure? So I find that my experience is that people call us in rather late in their trajectory, but my hope is that they would call us in much sooner.
You put it in a very beautiful way earlier. Death is not a problem to be solved. That's just so, it's just an eloquent way of putting it. You also touched on hospice. How is your role distinct from someone who might be from a hospice nurse or a palliative care physician, and kind of where do those lanes overlap?
I love this question because I think that there are a lot of assumptions about what we do that are misguided. So because we are non-medical people, even if we are in our other lanes of life, medical people, we do not act in that capacity in the role of the doula. So there are many, many doulas in the world who have come from hospice RN backgrounds, for example, or maybe they have been palliative care PAs. They don't come into the room when they are the doula to provide medical advice, to have conversations with people about specific medications, to provide them information that only a medical professional can provide. What we do instead is support the person as they navigate through conversations that are internal as well as external with people who are meaningful to them about the decisions that lay ahead. So I'm not in there even to do any body care. I'm not there to administer any medication or therapy. I am there strictly for the sort of support that tends to come out in the relational and conversational realms, but not clinical in any way. So in that role, we are a beautiful complement to hospice teams, for example. One of the hospice organizations that I volunteer with here in Phoenix has a volunteer end-of-life doula program. So my badge states clearly that I'm an end-of-life doula, and I work with the interdisciplinary team to create comprehensive, holistic support for the dying person and their circle of care. So I may have conversations and share information and experiences and descriptions of patient encounters with, say, the medical social worker or the chaplain or the CNA even or the RN, but I'm not going in there to step on their toes and walk into their lane. I'm there to have conversations to augment the support and also to figure out, well, how can we complement one another? What is a technique maybe that a social worker could have introduced that's non-medical for mitigation of breakthrough pain that I might be able to carry through in my encounters with the same patient or vice versa? So it's really sharing information as a team and a collaborative effort rather than coming in as an intruder or coming in as somebody who's duplicating efforts that are already there. Also, end-of-life doulas support folks who don't choose hospice, either because they have died before they have made that decision for themselves, or it's not right for them, or they are ineligible. Not everyone is eligible for hospice. And so we have community members who might be choosing to die on their own terms with the support that they have available to them, whether they are unhoused, whether they are living with another family member and they simply don't want to deal with the extra complexity of a whole team of people coming in at various hours of the day. They may have any number of reasons to say no to hospice, but they can still say yes to an end-of-life doula.
I actually got your name from a nurse we've worked with before, Kelly Rohn at the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, and she said that you went into their department and you spoke to some nurses or you spoke to the department. What does that conversation look like? Like, what are you talking to them about? Is it just kind of the general role or?
It's the general role. So when I was invited to come speak at the Grand Rounds for the Palliative Care Department at the Mayo Clinic here in Arizona, it was an educational opportunity for me to bring forward this role with accurate descriptions of what it is that we do, what it is that we don't do, and to kind of show how we add this integrative layer of support to the scenario. Sometimes this can look like, for example, a patient knowing that they have an upcoming appointment with a physician and having a lot of questions, but knowing that they get quite flustered when they're actually in front of their doctor. So I can role play with that person and they can practice asking me the questions. I can help them to document the questions that they have. We can help them to arrange for someone to accompany them, someone in their circle of care, to the appointment to document the answers. So we help the conversations that start and continue in the physician's offices to be held outside of those spaces as well. So we can help them in preparation. And then when they receive a diagnosis, when they receive some advice around maybe a suggested type of intervention, and they have time to think about and decide for themselves around those decision points, they can come back for the support of an end-of-life doula to help them think that through. So what that means is that the palliative care physicians, for example, know that they have someone who is not acting in a clinical advisory role, but who is acting in this neutral, compassionate, and yet still informed role of support on the other side. Because I'm removed from the, say, family dynamics, because I am not emotionally attached to this person, because they are not beholden to me in any way other than the construct of our engagement, I am a nice sounding board for them. So I am educated as an end-of-life doula around end-of-life choices, particularly the ones that are germane to the place where I live in the United States. And I'm also able to help bring the circle of care together. Sometimes it's separately, and sometimes it's with the dying person to have those conversations in more of a mediated way. So I'm not coming in as a mediator, but I'm able to facilitate those conversations in a more neutral way so that folks feel heard and supported and able to speak their truth out loud to one another in a space where they've got a neutral party sort of holding the room together. You'd asked the question earlier about who might engage the services of an end-of-life doula. So I do have a mix of dying people who come to me and say, I know that I'm dying. I know that my trajectory is unpredictable, but I want to be as prepared as possible before I reach that point. Sometimes I have folks who are the, say, the children, the adult children of a dying parent. And maybe that dying parent has a cancer diagnosis, and maybe that cancer has metastasized to the brain and it is impairing their cognitive function. So they are not really looking for the support of a doula in the same way that their child might be. So I may still provide companionship and some spiritual support to hold them in their belief system, some place for a conversation where people can be honest about their emotions and also sort of unburden themselves of things that they feel like they need to disclose to have more peace in their ending, but they don't want to tell their children. They don't want to tell their spouse. They may not even want to tell, say, a clergy person or a trusted community member or a best friend. I am there to receive that as well. But then I might be working concurrently with that adult child to help them prepare for the decisions they will need to make as their medical power of attorney, for example.
With patients with cancer specifically, we're in a time of like really great advancement for treatments, but even still, just by the nature of the disease, patients will experience significant symptom burdens, which can be prolonged and just kind of prolong the dying process. So how does that shape the kind of support you provide for a patient with cancer?
So I am always guided by the person who is dying, no matter what their diagnosis may be. With cancer, I would say specifically, because we have so many great treatment options available to people, and for certain types of cancers, you may have a longer timeline that could be sort of expected than with other cancers, it's going to look different for different people. What I try to hold most for all dying people, whether it is cancer or another disease that is going to eventually be responsible for someone's life ending, is to just sort of give them the space to know what is ahead and then know the options they have available for those decisions so that they can improve their quality of life for however long that lifespan is going to be. Now, when it comes to things like symptom burden and the way that pain arrives and discomfort arrives in the body, we know that there are pharmacological and medical interventions that can be put into place to help somebody mitigate, mediate, or palliate that pain. So there are some clinical techniques, obviously, that can be put to use when someone's experiencing pain. However, there are times when folks have breakthrough pain, or maybe the pain is not physical, but it is emotional. Or spiritual, more in that existential realm. So, as a doula, part of the support that I can provide for folks with increased symptom burden is techniques that are not in the medical realm, things like a body scan, so like a body-focused mindfulness practice, or let's say a guided visualization that can help. It's really sort of like a healthy distraction method to take folks away from focus on the pain that is ailing them in the moment and have them focus more on something that would balance that out, a time when their body was not in pain, a time when they felt happy rather than anxious. I will say also that doulas exist to hold people however they are in the moment. I'm not there to fix death, but I'm also not there to tell you, don't feel anxious, don't be scared, don't feel frustrated or resentful or angry. If those are the emotions that are arising for you along your journey, you are completely entitled to them, and I won't tell you to change them or change them for you. I will sit with you as you experience those emotions, even as you experience the bodily pain, and just move with you in the way that feels right for you. Often, people are just wanting to be heard, not fixed, not helped, not even hugged sometimes, but just to be witnessed in what they're going through as an authentic experience.
You just touched on a lot of great ways that you and your role can show up. What would you say are some of the biggest unmet needs you come across? that maybe someone in the clinical team, by no fault of their own, might not have the time or the training to address.
Well, I would never step into the clinical role, but I do encourage people I work with often to go to their clinicians and ask a lot of questions. So, something that comes up for me a lot in the work that I do with people is help to educate them about what we can know generally are the signs and symptoms and experiences of the body in the active dying phase. People will want to know what they want to know. The full Monty of information might be appropriate for some people, and others might decide, I don't want to know anything that might be coming. I just want to experience it in the moment. So, wherever they are, whatever feels like the right amount and intensity of information they want to have, however they want that titrated, I will meet them in that need. This is something that doesn't often get discussed until it becomes very close up on the horizon. But there are people who want to know what this will feel like so that they can plan then for their environment around that stage of dying. So, in the active dying phase, I can tell someone there will be changes in your breathing that we might see. There might be changes in your blood pressure, in your heart rate, in the appearance of your skin, in your consciousness, in the amount of time that you were awake versus asleep. I can explain and contextualize the sounds that they might hear their loved one making as they are breathing, and we're losing tone and the ability to swallow, and we're collecting those terminal secretions in the back of the throat. So it can feel reassuring to people to just have the information. And then they can use that as a framework to think through, okay, if I reach the stage, as most people do in my dying process, where I'm no longer conscious and able to speak for myself, because you've now told me that this is a possibility on the horizon and I don't know when it will happen. What would I like my circle of care to know about me and what I want so that they can advocate for me and execute for me on my behalf when I'm no longer able to vocally speak out or even write out or otherwise communicate in the usual way what it is that the decision would be that's right for me in that moment? I think the other thing that comes up for me a lot is that people have a lot more agency than they give themselves credit for. So, when it comes to medical decision making, the right choice for an individual may not match the advice of their provider, the opinions and preferences of their family, or even what they would have wanted for themselves 15 years ago. An example I like to give when I am in the role of educator for other end-of-life doulas is pain medication for people who are sober. So, a person who is, say, sober for 25 years may not want to take an opioid medication at end of life because it violates a piece of their identity. Just reinforcing for them that it's not my opinion about whether you should or shouldn't take any kind of medication, but that you have the choice for yourself is really, I think, a piece that doulas hold very well. We hold someone's autonomy in their identity. So, your values, your traditions, whether those are traditions of your heritage, of your community, of your faith tradition, of your family tradition, your individual preferences, that will color how you hold yourself in the dying process and how you help other people to continue to honor that all the way through. End of life is a high emotion, high intensity experience for many, many people. And when we are in a high stress environment, an environment of overwhelm and exhaustion for everybody involved, it can be very helpful to have documented what someone has clearly identified when they are in a decisional space so that we can give folks a resource and say, Tim has said that he really does not want lavender essential oil anywhere in the room when he is dying because he finds it really irritating. And so, when you lose the ability to speak as Tim, the dying person, and a well-meaning relative comes in with an essential oil diffuser with a lavender in it, it can be known to that person that Tim does not prefer this to be in the room. I just want to let you know that so that you can make a decision that honors Tim's wishes.
You're certified through INELDA, the International End of Life Doula Association, and you also have proficiency through NIDA, the National End of Life Doula Alliance. I'm just curious, kind of, what does the training and the credentialing landscape look like for death doulas?
I will add that I am also now an educator for INELDA, the International End of Life Doula Association. So, just for transparency's sake, I'm a trainer for that organization. Our training is different from, say, Going with Grace. It is different from the University of Vermont. It is different from any other program, and they are all unique to one another. I think that we hold the same foundation in the sense of wanting people to be educated about the physiological aspects of death and dying, supporting people in their autonomous decision making, being able to help people to plan for their last moments and also to work with the people who care for them in all of those realms, as well as things like remembrance projects. Making meaning, holding supportive space for people to process what they're experiencing, whether that is a dying person who's hitting some milestones in their dying trajectory, or it is the circle of care as they are experiencing first anticipatory grief and then the acute grief that comes post-demise. So I think we train under really the same pillars of education, but the delivery may be different. There is no national certifying body for end-of-life doula work. There is no license required for end-of-life doula work. So each organization is free to develop and present and deliver their unique training program as they decide they want to put it out into the world. And everyone is able to decide for themselves if that is a program that resonates with them from a value place, from an educational place, even from a learning style type of place. So there are places that will train online only. There are places that will train online as well as have in-person options. There are places that do retreat style. There are places that include a continuation and sort of a community-based support system or a mentorship. It's all a little bit different. Certification is the same. Certification is optional. So each organization might offer a certification that is meaningful to that organization. So in some cases, that means you achieve certification by taking a written exam. In other cases, you may have to supply some case studies from fieldwork. In other places, it might be a combination of those things. I know that with INELDA, our certification program has changed incredibly. In its last iteration, it is now a year-long commitment in a cohort-style environment that is continuing education and professional development and really refining the way that you deliver death work broadly in the world, rather than just giving somebody a rubber stamp and saying, I reviewed your cases and it looks like you know what you're doing and you have hit the standards that we internally have set as an organization to say that we vouch for you. So even the word certification, I think, is quite squishy, and it's up to the individual to decide if it's the right path for them. There is movement in places within the broad doula community around wanting to see end-of-life doula work be incorporated into the Medicare system in the way that birth doulas are now being able to be paid for through insurance systems. So I see pros and cons of that sort of incorporation. I like to try to see things from as many angles as possible. And so I can see the benefits, for example, in increasing access to people who may not be able to private pay for doula services at end of life. But I can also see Medicare and government systems coming in and constraining the role of the doula to only certain elements that they find palatable and reimbursable. So I can see ways where it's a benefit, and I can see ways where it might be a detriment to the practitioner and to the people we serve. But I just want to offer that that is in the conversation in the broader realm of the doula.
Do you have any anecdotes of patients or specific examples of patients with cancer who you've kind of worked with and helped make a difference for in their care?
Yes, I will share about an experience I had as a volunteer doula for the hospice organization that I'm with here in the Phoenix Valley. The patient to whom I was assigned had pancreatic cancer and also Lynch syndrome. And so, because Lynch syndrome is genetically inherited and increases your risk for things like pancreatic cancer, it was unsurprising to learn that her daughter also had pancreatic cancer, and she predeceased her mother with pancreatic cancer. So this patient had quite a lot of existential dread and anxiety around what she imagined her dying process would be like. She was living in the home of her nephew. And so myself and then a fellow volunteer doula colleague came together to visit this woman and her nephew and just be with them in whatever was going to unfold through this process. I was called in especially by the existing hospice care team to help support this woman in her anxiety. So she was definitely having breakthrough pain from the pancreatic cancer. But on top of that was this really intense layer of just worry, concern, and anxiety around the fact that she had already been through her daughter's death from the same conditions, and it was very painful. So her daughter had a lot of struggle and a lot of discomfort and pain at end of life, and this woman was carrying forth the experience of that in her body. So that was her daughter, but then it's also modeled for her what she then took in as, well, it's going to have to be like that for me too. So I was able to come in, do weekly visits with this woman, support the RN in, the management of the medication, in that the RN and I would sometimes have overlapping visits. And so we would talk about pain generally, and I would reach a point where I would say, well, here are some things that I can do with you as a doula, but then I know that our RN over here has some other options for you that are clinical. How about you continue the conversation about that piece with her at this moment? But really the outcome over time was that I wasn't there to fix her existential distress. I wasn't there to fix her anxiety. I was there to be with her and help her understand, where might this be coming from? Do I want to do anything about it? If yes, what are my options? And which one feels like the right tool at this time? So when I would come back week over week, it wasn't my expectation that she was on this sort of clinical model of diagnosis and, point of health, and we're going to move you along this trajectory with some really specific interventions. We're going to monitor benchmarks, and we're going to sort of track your progress. She couldn't fail. She couldn't not respond to treatment because that's not the model the doula operates under. So I am, with my colleague, really the only sort of person who's coming into the home as part of the hospice care team who's doesn't have a clipboard, isn't taking vital signs, isn't touching the physical body, isn't coming in to demand anything of her. It's to check in and work at her invitation for presence. And presence is by far the most powerful tool that we have. So when I would come to see this person, maybe one week she would have less anxiety than the week before. Maybe the next week her anxiety would increase, but then we would have a visit, and then I would find out that the calm that she experienced as a result of our presence would last for maybe a day, day and a half before things started to ramp back up again. But it was a very profound experience of seeing how a genetically inherited condition that can increase the risk of a particular type of cancer can manifest as sort of this like intergenerational inheritance of the experience too. And then how every death that we have experienced before us comes together to sort of shape and color our expectations about what it will look like for ourselves, as well as anybody else we know in their dying processes, particularly if it's the same cancer. However, that's one person with pancreatic cancer. I have companioned others with pancreatic cancer, and it is not that I walk into the room with the expectation that I will be facing the same body, having the same experience. It just happens to be the same word for the same diagnosis, but how that disease manifests itself in the body and how that person sort of metabolizes their emotional and spiritual experience is going to be very different person to person. So I walk in as a blank slate.
That was a really powerful anecdote. More looking into research, is there any research into whether doula support does reduce anxiety or improve bereavement outcomes or influence goals of care decisions? And if not, where are you personally seeing decisions made?
There is scant research to date that will measure the impact of end-of-life doulas on patient outcomes, quality of life, any particular element of the dying process, but it does exist. So there is some sound research out there that points to doulas having an impact that supports people in feeling more ease, more preparedness, and maybe some more acceptance of what is coming or what is coming for their loved one. I would love to see more research done. I would love to see clinicians reaching out actively to their non-medical counterparts like end-of-life doulas and the families and the circles of care who are going through this process of the disease progression to really cultivate that data set because it's so useful, not just in unlocking opportunities, but in unlocking understanding and integration.
Hopefully, as the death doulas become more mainstream, become more known throughout mainstream media, which I learned about your role predominantly through the show The Pit, which came out recently, the second season of which came out recently this year. And I think it introduced many people, including myself, to this concept for the first time. And I'm just curious, so the way the show portrays the death doulas work, does that resonate with your real world experience?
The way that the Pit portrayed the end of life doula resonates in certain ways, but does not in others. In fact, runs counter, I would say, to my training and experience as an end of life doula. I found it to be an interesting choice that for the end of life doula character, they married that to the person who was already an RN in the emergency department. As I said earlier, we have plenty of nurses who come in to do end of life doula work, but we separate those roles distinctly. So the separation was present in the sense that she came in her street clothes and she said, I'm here in this capacity, not in my shift capacity as an RN. However, there were a couple of things that she did that an end-of-life doula would not do, such as ask after a specific medication. She was asking about Keppra for seizures. I would not do that as an end-of-life doula. There was some taking on of the responsibility of arranging for durable medical equipment to be delivered to the home. And I remember the spouse in that episode saying, or maybe it was the dying person saying, well, who's going to order all of this stuff? And the doula saying, well, I'm going to do that. I've got that. Don't worry about that. Really, that is the hospital social worker and the hospice social worker co-coordinating that delivery, that setup, and that care. And then with the spouse, who is the person who'd be there to receive that, when can it come? How can we set this up for you? So there was a little bit of an overstep in some places that I would not say are within the scope of the doula as I understand and perform that role. But there were lots of places where what she was doing was exemplary of what we do, holding space for the children when they knew their mother was dying, having a conversation in the hallway when the child felt too scared or uncertain about coming in and saying goodbye to his mother. Advocating for the dying person to go with what it was that she wanted for herself, which was to remain in the hospital and not go home to die. So there were lots of places where I think the role was presented really beautifully. And I love that it's even introduced because doulas can be present in a highly medicalized setting like that. It is not always at home hospice. But there were a couple of places where I thought that there was some overstep into the clinical role or just the assumption of responsibility, whereas a doula would look first to the circle of support and say, who has capacity to step in and support your beloved person in this way, rather than assuming I'm going to go in and fix everything or set this up for you. So we work really at invitation. And again, we always defer to the circle of care and the support network that's in place for the person who is dying.
Yeah, I'm really glad I asked that question just because I was curious to see what was realistic and what wasn't, or what might have been played out for the production of television, or what might not have been. So those are all the questions I had, but is there anything else you want to say?
I would say that many doulas I know, myself included, are so eager to have conversations and build relationship with the medical side of end-of-life care, with our RNs, with our physician's assistants, with our physicians, really with anybody who interacts with a person who's been diagnosed with serious illness. We want to build relationship and community so that we have this very strong web of care that can be offered to the people who exist in our space. So I would say if you are curious as a practitioner about end-of-life doulas, there are directories. Enelda has one. You can go to enelda.org and look for end-of-life doulas in your area. Cold call, invite conversations, maybe be open to being receptive to invitations for conversation that come from the other direction. The medical professionals I have encountered, even if they have not known previously what an end-of-life doula is and how we support, tend to walk away so enthused about the ways that we can augment one another's care. So I really think there's potential to bring this extra strong layer of support to folks who are seeking, seeking treatment, and just really improved quality of life throughout their disease trajectory. So quality of life, can be in the last 2 weeks of your life, it can be in the next 12 years of your life. So, planning for end of life is something everyone should do because it is coming for all of us and we just don't know when. Even if you have cancer, that might not be the thing that ends your life.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or you can listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the Journal of Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancernetwork.